We're living in the age of instant celebrity, where blogs, Twitter, Facebook, and the rest of the internet are said to provide every person with the opportunity of at least 15 minutes of fame. And most people assume that the better you do your job, the more well-known you'll become. David Zweig's new book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion, celebrates a different kind of competence, the behind-the-scenes expertise that may fly under the radar, but without which the show cannot go on. We spoke in July, and that conversation is being rebroadcast for you today. I started by asking him, is the idea that part of one's professional goal is to become well-known fairly new?
I don't think so. People, you can go all the way back to the ancient Greeks. People have always desired some degree of fame in different cultures. But what I argue that's different today is that largely, but though not exclusively, due to our communications technology, social media, that there's really been this enabling and an amplification of this desire. So it really has exploded an instinct that we have for a long time.
In the past, it was mostly based on achievement.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seems to be the case, that we've always valued some degree of attention or recognition, but largely because attention and recognition have a correlation with money, with power. But now, to a certain degree, people are just valuing attention for its own sake.
In things like viral videos, reality TV shows, have they changed the value and meaning of fame? Is fame now desired for its own sake rather than as a result of major achievement?
Yeah, I think that's right for a lot of people. And even if people are seeking something beyond simply fame, that we're under, I think, a large illusion to the most part in the notion that fame, that you're going to get that. One of the scholars I spoke with communications and whatnot, he said that, you know, the notion that someone's going to put a video on and have it be one of those viral success videos on YouTube, he said, that's the same as entering the lottery. It's an illusion for most of us.
Certainly Achilles was not advised to make himself a brand.
Exactly right.
But do you think that's undermining the value systems for our society, or is this just something that is the latest development?
Well, I make the case in the book that I think we've always had this sort of great, what I call American noise, where people, you know, you can think of the Hollywood Klieg lights that shine to the world and Cornelius Vanderbilt with his like wild sideburns. And there's always been this great American noise. And I don't want to lose that. But that's always been balanced with what this sort of like puritanical nose to the grindstone mentality, the quiet dignity of the average American, as David Foster Wallace called it. And now what I argue is that that balance has now become off kilter, where there's too much noise and not enough of just this dignity of doing your work.
David Foster Wallace became a celebrity and then he committed suicide. Can fame also be a great distraction or a problem?
Yeah, of course. I mean, look at all the famous people who don't seem to be happy. All you have to do is open up, you know, Us Weekly or hop online in any one of a zillion different websites to see that. And that fame doesn't necessarily bring you happiness. But let's even take it down a notch. Even not everyone's seeking fame on that scale, but even just the attention that it seems like so many of us are seeking today. If you think about, nearly all of us spend so much time online, and I think we all, in some way, are taught that we need to seek our own little micro celebrity, everyone hoping for more and more likes on all of their posts and kind of secretly hoping for more followers. In this, but it's really, you know, it's kind of that dangling carrot that you're never going to reach. Attention, it feels great. This is fun for me being on the radio with you. It's nice having my name on the cover of my book, but ultimately, it's the feeling you get from attention doesn't last.
And many people have become internet sensations without being able to translate that into making a living.
That's exactly right. There's a number of cases I cite in the book where people in a variety of different fields had an enormous amount of buzz around them and their work, but ultimately they weren't able to translate that into actual success.
And even thinking about fame, we're going to live forever. Irene Cara, what happened to her?
Right. Well, she caught a few dollars from me to use that quote in my book. So she's still doing
How would you define what you call an invisible?
I used to be an invisible. I worked for a number of years as a magazine fact checker at a number of Condé Nast magazines. And the thing about that job is the better you do that job, the more you disappear. And it had this sort of inverse relationship between work and recognition, where if I was perfect, I was invisible.
It's only when you made a mistake that people noticed.
That's exactly right. You never read, in the line I like to say is, when's the last time you've read a great magazine article and thought to yourself, oh man, that was fact checked beautifully. You know, never. It's only if something's wrong that you notice a fact checker that you would ever think about them. And I thought, this is so odd to be in this job where I can do a great job and no one's going to know. And yet, the strange thing was, unlike a whole bunch of different day jobs I had over the years where I was kind of secretly surfing the web half the day and doing whatever, I actually found the job really rewarding at the end of the day. And that was the thing that always stuck with me.
People assumed that if something was published in The New Yorker, it got past the fact checker. Does the fact checker influence the piece substantially?
They certainly do. And, you know, and that varies from piece to piece. So, right, I'm glad you mentioned The New Yorker, right? I interviewed the Peter Camby, the head of the fact-checking department at The New Yorker for my book. And they certainly have an influence on the scope of a piece and what direction it goes. And if a fact-checker, you know, says no to something, that's it. It's not going to run. That's certainly, at least in magazines that really have a deep respect for quality journalism.
What kinds of facts did you check? Because they can be fact checkers who are doing work of great importance, and they're fact checkers who are finding out that some momentary star wasn't really born in Brookline, Mass., but right. In Brooklyn, New York.
Right. Well, right. A couple things. One person's important thing, you know, someone else is unimportant and vice versa. Maybe that's not important to you, but for all the fans of that star. But you're right. Of course, an article in The New Yorker on some deep political issue has a different level of importance that the facts are kept straight versus, you know, a celebrity puff piece somewhere else. That's for sure. But for the fact checker, really, in the end, it doesn't matter. Your job is solely to make sure that everything in there is correct.
My guest is David Zweig, Z-W-E-I-G. His book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion, published by Penguin in its Portfolio imprint. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're a writer now, sitting here addressing the public. You also have performed as a singer-songwriter and a record producer. Is the fact checker just an anomalous part of your life?
Well, no. I think, you know, that role was something I did for a number of years. But the reality is that invisibles, the people as I define them in the book, that ultimately it's not even about whether you're seen or not. What the people in the book show is that by embodying certain traits, that ultimately leads to success and fulfillment. So even though I am in a very visible role now, at least as visible as a writer is going to be in our culture today, that even in this role, what I learned as I went along the way in interviewing these people and doing the research with different business scholars and psychologists and whatever, was that the traits that these people embody really can be taken by anyone, regardless of what your role is.
Is the job of the fact checker respected at the publication? Is it only the general public that doesn't understand or recognize the importance of this work?
You know, I think for the fact checkers, it probably varies from magazine to magazine. They certainly don't accord the same level of prestige as the writers or the editors. That's
and you don't
sure.
get paid as much.
They don't get paid as much either, generally, you know, unless you're talking about someone who's the head of a department. But you're right. But I mean, whether it's the fact checker or any of these other invisibles, it depends on pace to place, but their role, the thing that was fascinating about them is that their whole role is to basically disappear. That's the point of it, which is kind of the opposite of how it seems like we're told we should be living today.
Do invisibles tend to be introverts, or is it just that they fell into this job and they turn out to be invisible?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You know, I found to be a pretty strong correlation between people who are a little more introverted and staying in these invisible type roles. However, it is not a one-to-one thing. A number of the people I met with, the guy named Jim Harding, who is a guy in this interesting field called wayfinding, where he helps design the signs and systems for airports to help you kind of get from point A to B to C. He was incredibly personable, very gregarious fellow. So a number of these people are actually really master collaborators. That's one of the chapters in the book where I talk about the art of collaboration. So it's not necessarily, to be an invisible doesn't mean you're meek or hiding in the corner somewhere. It just means that you value your work and the larger enterprise more than gaining attention for yourself.
Has wayfinding evolved over time as places like airports or subway systems have become more complex?
Yeah, I think wayfinding has evolved over time. And the thing that's really amazing about it is that you think that wayfinding is really just about creating these signs, you know, what typeface to use, what illustration to use. But the thing that Jim Harding that I get into in the book, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a whole lot of stuff that they do that actually has nothing to do with signs, that it's about using these subtle and even subconscious cues to move us from one place to the next without us even realizing it. So I talk about that, how we're at the Atlanta airport and how they've done all sorts of things there to usher, you know, the masses of people without them even knowing it.
You talk about the three C's of wayfinding.
Right, yeah. So Jim Harding has just this whole kind of system worked out from connectivity and all these other factors about how everything there is really, he said, it's like a spider web. You change one sign and in some regards, you have to change everything. So and how all of his work is really interdependent. And I think that's a nice metaphor for invisibles as a whole, that when you do something, it's seeing things from the kind of 30,000 foot view.
Why do some aberrations in logic occur in an airport like Maynard Jackson in Atlanta? For example, why is Terminal T before Terminal A, B, C, and D?
Well, you know, the thing is there are different stakeholders in every project, whether it's in airports or any industry, right? So with wayfinding, ultimately, while having the best system for the travelers is their goal, they also are beholden to the people paying their bills and other people. And sometimes their goals may be a little bit divergent from ours as travelers as to where they want you to go or where they want you to slow down and stay.
You mentioned typefaces. Why are sans serif typefaces used in almost any large public environment and often the same typeface Helvetica?
Yeah, I say in the book, I'm like, if you've been wandering around, you know, a city or even traveling the world and you kind of have the sense that everything just looks the same everywhere, you're not going crazy. That is true, that certain typefaces, there's like three typefaces that are used in something like three quarters of the airports around the world, Helvetica, Frutiger, and Clearview, that they have certain characteristics to them that were specifically created. Frutiger was specifically created for, I think, Charles de Gaulle Airport, that the letters are the most legible from a distance. And that's particularly important now because travelers are aging, a lot of them. So they really wanted to make – that's why all the street signs are changed in New York and other places, by the way, to capital and lowercase. That's also more legible than all caps.
Is it important to also accommodate people who have come from different parts of the world and have different cultural references?
Yeah, that's one of the things I loved, and I have some fun illustrations in the book where you can see how the man image or woman image that you see, you know, on the outside of a restroom, how it changes from one place to the next, how in, you know, Geneva, a woman has a shorter skirt. In Frankfurt, it's longer, you know, things like that. So there's some really fun examples of how our imagery changes from one place to the next. But the reality is that most of these images are pretty much from the same kind of library, the same look, and this sort of almost like a tyranny of a certain aesthetic around the world.
Why wouldn't a serif typeface be okay?
Well, I'm not an expert on typefaces.
Since Times Roman is a very popular typeface, and it's a serif typeface.
Well, apparently some studies show that serif typefaces are easier to read when you're reading close up, like in a book, or you're reading a lot of text. You know, newspapers are written in serif typefaces. But when you're looking at something from a distance, sans serif is considered to be more legible. And it also has something to do, I think, with like a minimalism aesthetic today.
David Zweig has written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and other publications. He's also written a novel called Swimming Inside the Sun. And now his latest book is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. It is published by the portfolio imprint of Penguin Books. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a rebroadcast of my conversation with David Zweig. His book is called Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. So you've written a novel. You've been a singer-songwriter, musician, record producer, fact checker.
Long list.
Can't you just settle in on something? Or
I think I've settled into this, hopefully.
Which is what?
If enough people buy this book, I'll settle into being a writer.
Why do you discuss the career of the marathoner Bill Rogers in terms of an invisible? He's definitely not invisible.
Ooh, that's a great one. Yeah, I talk about Bill Rogers a little bit because, you know, back when he started, running was not this kind of known thing that it is today. That was, you know, really a burgeoning kind of sport. So I give these anecdotes about, you know, he talked about when he started, people used to throw beer cans at him when he was like running on the streets of Boston.
The Boston Marathon, they threw beer cans?
No, not during the Boston Marathon, when he was training. That, you know, hey, what's up? You know, what's with those funny shorts you're wearing and throwing? You can just totally picture this happening with some guy in Southie chucking a can at him or something. But he said, you know, in order to keep him going, he had to really just love what he was doing. There was no notion that he was going to be famous the way he became afterward. At the time, he just was dedicated to his craft of running. And that's really this kind of beautiful anecdote, I think, about all these people in the book, that they, even famous people among us, that for most of them, they became famous, the famous people we respect, at least, that they became famous not because that was their goal. That was merely a byproduct of being excellent at what they do. That it's a bit of a cart before the horse thing. When people are striving for fame as its own thing, you need to strive for excellence, and then the fame hopefully will come after, if that's really what you want.
In your research, did you find that they had other things in common in terms of either their educations or their upbringings? Were they in any way sheltered from the pressures of our society, that the sorts of thing that usually is put on people who do a good job but aren't well known?
Mm. Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, there are a few core traits that all the invisibles I profile in the book share. And these are people across a really wide range of industries. You have someone like Jim Harding, who does wayfinding. I have a structural engineer for skyscrapers.
You know, you have a perfumer.
I have a perfumer.
Important to me, radio producer.
That's right. That's right. You know, there is a room of people sitting next to us right now beyond a glass wall, producers and, you know, sound people, they're waving at us now, that their radio listener doesn't think of. And that the formula for most of the invisibles is the better they do their job, the more they disappear. These people, you're never going to think of the sound guy when you're listening to the Leonard Lopate show, unless something goes wrong, then he's noticed. So then you have to wonder, well, what is someone's reward when, if they do their job perfectly, that no one's thinking of them? And it's this sort of ambivalence toward recognition. It's this, you know, really savoring the work itself.
Isn't my announcement at the end of the show that Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls and the list of the various producers, isn't that enough for these people?
Well, I think it is, actually. And that's the point, that it's not that invisibles are immune to wanting attention or that a recognition is bad. On the contrary, many of them are really highly respected within their fields. It's just that that's not what motivates them. That in the end, that, and I think we all sense this on an intuitive level, that what's really going to make us feel fulfilled is going to be the value of our work, not the volume, you know, of praise we get. I think we all sense this, but I think that message has been lost in our culture today, that where attention just seems to be the one metric of value above everything else.
Some of these professions, people aren't even aware exist. One of the careers you focus on is that of the perfumer. What does a perfumer do?
Yeah, so one of the people in the book is named David Appel, and he is a master perfumer, or they call it a nose in the industry. And he designs the fragrances for people like Calvin Klein, Tom Ford, Hugo Boss. And I follow him along the story when he developed Sean John, a.k.a. P. Diddy, a.k.a. Diddy.
Sean Combs.
Sean Combs, thank you. Yes, you had one more a.k.a. for me. So I follow along. It's an incredible story about how he designed his first male celebrity fragrance that became this enormous blockbuster success. And, you know, David Appel, you never think of the perfumer. But what I hope for at the end of reading this book is that you will never go enter an airport the same way again. You will never smell your wife or an old flint, that perfume, the same way again. You will never enter a concert hall the same way again. That I want to expose these behind the scenes worlds that really affect what we do, what we see, but yet we never think about them.
But do they keep the celebrity whose name is going to go on the perfume in mind when they create this special scent, or could Puff Daddy's perfume be just as easily Eminem's perfume?
Oh my gosh, no!
Eminem would never have a perfume. He would probably write a rap about killing the perfumer.
Right. Yeah, it's very much the former. That in order to create these fragrances, there's an extraordinary process involved where they're given what's known as a brief, and sometimes the brief can be a page long, or it can be many, many pages and involve videos and all sorts of other stuff. Where whether it's a celebrity or whether it's just a fashion brand, where they're given instructions on, we want it to smell like blank, and his job is to turn metaphor. You know, we want it to smell like a cloud. You know, saying that means nothing, and he has to somehow translate that metaphor into reality. So with Diddy's fragrance, it was supposed to have this Mediterranean freshness was the key terms that jumped out at David.
And did he keep on being consulted about it as the process went along?
So it's pretty remarkable. Diddy was really involved in the process. And again, you know, this is a great example of how invisible traits, you know, here's a guy who's incredibly famous, but yet to me, learning about the behind the scenes of how his first fragrance was created, to me, it's no mistake that he became famous because he was embodying real invisible traits. One of them is meticulousness. And this guy was just involved in every detail of the process. You wouldn't think that. You think that a celebrity like him, maybe he's just, you know, putting his face out front. But what we don't realize is a lot of times for certain celebrities, and I'm not talking about a reality TV show star necessarily, I'm talking about people who are more respected within our culture, that they got there most likely because they were doing an extraordinary amount of behind the scenes work.
So we don't have to ask, did he or didn't he? as an aside, you talk about working as a fact checker for Vogue and fact checking an article about perfume. What fact did you struggle with? and how did David Apel explain it to you?
Yeah, so when I was at Vogue, there was a fragrance called Princess by Vera Wang that came out at that time. And there was an article that was supposed to run on it. And one of the notes in the fragrance that was described as to smell like pink frosting. And as a indignant fact checker, I said, there's no such smell as pink frosting. That's just food coloring. It smells the same as white frosting. So I spoke to the editor. We got on the phone with people at Vera Wang, you know, and I was like, this isn't correct. There's no such thing as the smell of pink frosting. Ultimately, I actually lost, sadly.
And, well, it's a metaphor, isn't it?
It is, but that's, but you know, as a fact checker, your job is to be persnickety. Your job, and then ultimately you let the editor, because let me tell you something, it's better to put the brakes on something and let the editor say, nah, this is fine, let it run through, versus erring on the side of, oh, this seems okay, and then you run into real trouble if something gets printed that shouldn't be there.
My guest is David Zweig. His book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. One of the things you look into is simultaneous translation. When was that invented?
I believe it largely came to be during the Nuremberg trials. That was the first time where it was a speed was really critical. You know, before then, if someone was interpreting, and in the book, I talk about the distinction between translation and interpretation. They're two very different things. But when interpretation really started, someone who was bilingual or multilingual would hear the speaker talk. They'd wait a moment until the speaker finished, then they would talk. But simultaneous interpretation, which is a woman named Julia Wilkins RE, who is one of the big profiles in the book, she's an elite interpreter at the United Nations. What she and her colleagues do is that they are interpreting while the person is speaking. So if you imagine someone is speaking French, she's listening to the French, and while they're speaking, she's translating in her mind and then speaking English, but while the person is still speaking without taking a break, and they just keep going. It's remarkable.
Why is there a distinction made between translation and interpreting?
Translating is when you deal with the written word, and those people can take as long as they want, but interpretation is on the fly. And I call her chapter The Unlikely Adrenaline Junkie, because she's this very sweet woman, a bit frail. She's wearing a cardigan with wireframe glasses. But really, her work is about, there's this psychological state that they call flow. And a lot of the invisibles get into that, where she's just in the zone. That is an extraordinary mental feat in order to be doing what she's doing. They're only allowed to go for a half hour at a time because it's just so taxing to do this work.
Because it's really split brain. But Do they also try to catch affect, or just simply the be as accurate as possible? With
no, no. They really – there's a real – art to what they're doing. You know, language, there's almost never a one-to-one translation from one language to another. So what they do, not only are they translating the language in their mind, but they then have to formulate the idea of what someone is saying into the other language. Rather, there is no one-to-one, you know, one word to another from one language to the next.
And you give that chapter the subtitle, The Unlikely Adrenaline Junkie.
Yeah, she is a fantastic woman, and it's just that one of the studies I cite in the book is that they found that the mental stress load on simultaneous interpreters is akin to that of soldiers in the Israeli army. There is an interpreter. I keep saying this, I don't want to give too much away.
You could give it away. Right, it's okay. People, there's still a lot that we're not going to cover.
That's right. Yeah. We're not doing 280 pages worth of stuff today. So one of, I love this story. When Gaddafi was giving a speech at the UN, he brought – sometimes people would – diplomats would bring in their own interpreters if they didn't use a staff person.
And so he had a 95-minute speech planned.
So he has this incredibly long speech. And again, remember I said interpreters, because the work is just so taxing, they usually only go in half-hour shifts. His guy was talking – I think it was over an hour. And finally – he screams into the microphone, "I can't take it anymore." And he collapsed. And then because it was way beyond what he could do. And you know what happened? The guys in the Arabic interpretation booth kind of pushed him over to the side and they kept going. They picked up where he left off.
And Gaddafi didn't know.
No, I mean, they just kept going. That's dedication.
The translators use a lot of body language, even though nobody's seeing them.
Yeah, one of the things that was really cool is, and I get into some detail describing just how things look at the UN. Just a little side note here. This is one of the really neat things about the Invisibles who I profile in the book, is that we think that the person at the top of the pyramid is the person who has all the power. But man, these people in the book, I was able to gain access to places where people never get to go, like getting into a closed door meeting at the UN at the Disarmament Council. The media are almost never involved in these things. Or when I was at, went to the Shanghai Tower, which while it was under construction in China, you know, a journalist from America, we don't get to go to these types of places, but I was there with the structural engineer. So just as an interesting side note, that these invisibles, people, we often equate visibility with power and visibility with the highest honor, but these people, their responsibility, that's what they enjoy, you know, this behind the scenes role. So that's how I got in there.
And they're also often translating people who have strange accents. It's not just a matter of whether they all speak perfect Arabic or French or Polish or whatever. What do you mean by the phrase culture of profile?
Yes. One of the things I talk about is, as I think I brought up at the very beginning of our talk here, is that today, largely due to social media, we're really in this environment where attention is this metric of value. And there is a scholar called Warren Sussman who wrote about the culture of character from many, many years ago, that people, your worth was based on your character of who you were as a person. Then what happened was, over time, as the world became more urbanized, that it then moved from a culture of character to a culture of personality, which was, instead of you being about who you were on the inside, it was more about how other people perceived you. And what I argue is, I add a third phase, that today we've moved from the culture of personality to the culture of the profile, where we're even one step beyond just the personality, that today the online environment is as different from our urbanized, you know, environment as that was from the rural world preceding it.
You mentioned sports teams putting players' names on the backs of their uniforms, or some sports teams do. In the old days, we just had to simply know the number of the player.
Yeah. They call them NNOBs, which stands for No Name on Back. That's the jargon of people who...
The Yankees.
That's right. So, and what I trace the, you know, in roughly the 1960s, the beginning of the 1960s, prior to that point in time, professional teams did not have the players' names on their uniforms. But then once the 60s roll around, that's when they became introduced in a Major League Baseball, and then slowly in all of our major sports. And I trace the rise of names on the backs of their uniforms, and that mirrors the rise of individualism in our society.
It's also a response to television. Just one more thing, because we have very little time. There are some people who are famous who say the most outrageous things. I'm not going to mention their names. Often make political claims that are just totally ridiculous. And yet they wind up being on television all the time. Other people who are really right on all the time get ignored. So is something else going on there? Are the invisibles sometimes hurting themselves by being invisible?
Well, being an invisible, as I define them here and these people in the book, it's not about being meek or hiding in the corner. It's about having your work be the focus of your attention and having the larger enterprise. And what's amazing is that these people became successful by doing the opposite of what we're told, by not seeking attention.
David Zweig's book is called Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. The book is published by Penguin in its Portfolio imprint. And David, good luck as a musician, as a writer, and whatever else you do to not be invisible yourself.
Most of my work is, though, indeed invisible. Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, we'll look at attempts to create more profit-sharing and employee-owned companies in the United States and their possible consequences. And then high-wire artist and magician Philippe Petit tackles the nature of creativity. Urban beekeeper James Fisher shares tips on how to maintain a hive in New York City. And we will look at the environmental hazards that come with fertilizing your lawn. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, and Andres O'Hara Plotnick. Melissa Higgins, the executive producer. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls, and we had help today from Hugh Sansom, Julie Dario, Amanda Carrilla, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the rest of your Labor Day.